This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 29th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me today Dennis Fisher. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Gary.
Dennis Fisher is the executive editor of the Security Media Group at TechTarget. He helps run SearchSecurity.com and Information Security Magazine. Dennis has spent over 12 years reporting on the security industry, including a long stint at eWeek. He has a degree from James Madison University, which recently jumped 81 in Virginia. Dennis lives with his family near Boston with absolutely no Datsuns whatsoever. So you've been covering security for the tech press for a long time.
I have.
I was trying to remember the first time I chatted with you. Do you remember when that was?
Well, it must have been at eWeek, and I'm trying to remember what it was about, but I'm guessing it had something to do with the horrific full disclosure debate that's been...
Oh, yeah. That was back before PC... after PC Week became eWeek.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because I was looking up old articles from the Java security days. Oh. We found a couple of PC Week ones, but yeah, they're not on the net anymore.
No, they're not. They've archived them, but they're pretty tough to find.
It's sort of lost in the haze. So in those 12 years that you've been doing this, have you seen the BS factor in the commercial part of the field change over the years?
Oh, yeah. I think it's amplified to a pretty big degree. I mean, when I first started covering security, it wasn't really a huge sector of the industry. You know, networking was a big deal. Wireless networking was taking off, mobile, all that kind of stuff. And security was just sort of this little backwater, and the only time you ever heard about it was when there was a big virus like Melissa or I Love You or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, that's when all the vendors would sort of play the terror card and scare people into buying more stuff. But that's become a sort of a 24/7 cycle these days.
So you're thinking there's just more of the BS.
I think there is, yeah. And I mean, I'm certainly not exempt from having, you know... It participated in that cycle, but you know, I think it's a case of there's been more high profile incidents in the last few years that have hit the mainstream press as well as the tech press, and that's gotten security into the general consciousness as well as sort of the specter of terrorism as well that some companies have played up. So it's definitely amplified in the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little confused about the whole thing because I agree that it's amplified, but I don't understand why after all the spectacular stories like, you know, the New York City blackout and the TJ Maxx story, why do you think the general public has such a lax attitude towards computer security still?
That's a terrific question. I've written a few columns about that, and honestly, I haven't been able to figure it out. I think it's just that most of the general public doesn't really understand the way that the internet works or the way that computers themselves work, and they don't understand all of the, you know, the intricacies. So they figure, you know, okay, if I have the little padlock down in the bottom corner of my browser, I must be safe. And they don't understand why somebody can still steal their credit card data from TJX.
Right.
You know, they don't understand that it wasn't stolen while it was being transmitted. It was, you know, stolen from a back office computer somewhere. And it's just, I think it's just a general lack of understanding, and that, you know, they kind of brush it off and think, well, you know, that's all that techie stuff. I don't need to worry about it. There's engineers somewhere behind the curtain taking care of it.
Right. So it's sort of the idea that it's magic and that you can't do anything about it. So marginally interesting, but what the heck?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you bring up the TJX thing, and there's a great story about that. I was standing in a TJ Maxx store about 3 days after that breach became public up in the Boston area where they're based, and the woman ahead of me was about to swipe her debit card, and she asked the cashier, she sort of, you know, she stopped for a second, she looked at the cashier and said, well, I heard you guys had some security problems, and the cashier, this nice, you know, 75-year-old woman said, oh, they've taken care of that. Don't worry about it. Woman went right ahead, swiped her credit card, and was, you know, off and running. So.
That sounds like a firewall.
Exactly, right.
It's all good. These are not the droids you're looking for.
That's right. The Jedi mind trick in practice at Marshall's.
So yeah. Do you think that there's anything that can be done to educate the non-technical audience about security or the severity of the problem, or are we doing the right thing and we just got to keep doing it till it sticks?
I think there are some things that can be done. You know, some of the larger technology vendors have tried. You know, Microsoft has had some programs for the general public out there, and you know, there's a few vendor alliances that have tried the same thing, but I think it really just comes back to the fact that most people don't want to have to worry about it. I think it's sort of like the stock market. Nobody really understands how it works, or you know, there's very few people that understand how it works, and most of the rest of us just sort of put our money in and hope that more money comes out on the other end at some point.
When we retire.
Right, exactly. Whenever that is. I'm not sure how much the education efforts can help. I mean, if we can't really get the developers or half of the other, you know, computer geeks to pay attention to security, I'm not sure how much we can count on the general public to pay attention.
Right. So I guess, you know, the tech press can't really help there since it's a hopeless situation. But what role can the tech press play in cutting through vendor nonsense, like we were talking about at the top of the show?
Yeah, I think it's a very important role. It's definitely shifted over the years since I started it at what was then PC Week. There was a lot of very product-focused stories. You know, Cisco's got this new switch coming out, Microsoft's got this new software package coming out, mm-hmm. and there was very little sort of analysis or anything like that. It was a lot of just, you know, regurgitating what was happening.
Security as a thing.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So I think in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, you've seen a lot more intelligent analysis of the security issues at hand than we had beforehand. You know, I'm not taking any credit for that, but I think there's definitely a role for folks like me and other writers to play in sort of filtering all of that and cutting through what the vendors are telling them and telling them, listen, okay, here's what they're saying, but here's what the reality is going to be when it gets to your end.
Have you ever had to call nonsense on a security vendor?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a daily occurrence for a long time when I would say in 2002, 2003, when there was all of the sort of terrorist hysteria that somehow got translated into computer security hysteria, which never really made a lot of sense to
me. I think it was NIMDA.
It might have been, yeah, because that happened right afterwards. Yep. But, yeah, there was a ton of that, all kinds of specious, you know, ideas and vendors and all of that kind of thing happening. And, you know, there were a lot of them where you just kind of said, you know, you can stop talking now. There's not much you can say that's going to convince me you have anything that's going to help customers at all.
Right. So what did they do when you told them that?
Most of the time they kind of hung their heads because they, you know, often they had $60 or $100 million of VC money in their pocket and they were looking for some way to spend it. So
that's right. This is before the bubble
right, yeah.
finished.
So it depended on the vendor, I guess. Some of them were vets who had been through several, you know, spin cycles with startups and knew how the game worked and mm-hmm. knew they needed to just find a message to latch onto, and that was more important than a good product in a lot of ways. But half of them got it, half of them didn't, I think.
So this is kind of an unfair question, but what the heck? Did advertising and the role of advertising in the tech press, you know, supporting your life, kind of ever have an impact on those stories?
I can't say it ever had a direct impact on anything I wrote, although I definitely sat in meetings where I was hearing from editors much farther up the food chain saying, listen, we're getting a lot of heat from vendor X saying they want to pull their advertising because of this story from last week. And
could you start being more mealy-mouthed, please?
Yeah, to their credit, I'll have to say that nobody ever came to me and said, listen, you know, you need to take it a little easier on Microsoft or Cisco or whoever, Oracle, whoever the case may be, most of the time they just said, you know, they're, if the story's right, then they're just going to have to take their medicine.
Right.
You know? And there were definitely times, I mean, I can recall a few times when advertising was definitely pulled over stories, but I don't think that, it's sort of one of those conspiracy theories that I think people latch onto, sort of like, you know, the antivirus companies write viruses,
right,
that kind of thing.
Right.
But it's a legitimate concern. It definitely happens at some publications. I mean, I
think there's some that are, you know, more spurious than others. The ones that you've worked for are pretty straight ahead.
Yeah, you're right. There's a sort of, you know, a spectrum like anything else. And I know reporters at plenty of other publications that have felt a lot more pressure on that front.
There's sort of another aspect of pressure that's worth talking about. We discussed the NASCAR effect on your podcast last week.
Right.
And we'll provide a link to that podcast on the site. So it seems that stories about doing things right, like, you know, stuff in software security, are doomed to be less popular than stories about doing the wrong thing, like exploiting online games. So do you see this phenomenon in your journalism and the results of publishing certain kinds of stories?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. I can tell you that I can't even count the number of emails we would get when, especially when I was at eWeek, sort of in the days of the Code Red, NIMDA, Slammer, Worm of the Month type thing.
Right.
All the emails we would get about people saying, why don't you write some positive security stories, you know, case studies of people saying, you know, here's how we defended against this, or here's how we did this.
Write a story about how nothing happened, please.
Exactly. And that's how you have to explain it to them. It's a lot like, you know, a daily newspaper where you find, you know, reporters rushing out to cover fires and car crashes and that kind of thing, but nobody ever pays attention to the city council meetings or...
I don't know, man. My paper is so small that what they cover is what these kids, the animals the kids are going to show at the fair. That's been a big series over the last few weeks in my paper.
See, that's a good paper. That's valuable journalism right there. I like that.
So what do you do to try to provide a balance? Is there anything you can do, or do you just have to kind of go with what people are interested in reading about?
Yeah, a lot of it is really what people are interested in. You know, we follow the traffic on our site very closely. We look at what people are interested in. You know, it's sort of immediate market research. We can tell what stories people are reading and which ones they're not interested in. And, you know, although the case study stories do very well, the ones that, you know, sort of provide an in-depth look at how some university or large enterprises, you know, deployed some product and it's really helped them.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of cases, it's definitely the new hacking technique that's really terrifying that does the best.
It's
the sort of...
So FUD continues to sell.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does. I mean...
Was that Joe Walsh, the dirty laundry thing?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. But I think... There's clearly some value to that, though. I mean, people in the business do need to understand that there's XYZ new attack out there, or there's a new problem that they need to pay attention to. But there's a sort of there's a way that you can turn the volume down without, you know, so that you're not shouting about every little flaw as if it's the end of the world.
I think there's a way of using that as kind of bait on the hook of talking about the right thing to do too. That's what I've tried to do in my work. You know,
I think that's an excellent point. Yeah.
So you can attract people's attention by talking about how stuff breaks, and then you can, while you have them captive,
right,
teach them how not to do that.
Yeah.
Or how to build a better system.
I think that's an excellent point. And not enough of that is done. I think, at least on my end of the business, we certainly have a lot of educational content on our site,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of an exception in the business. But it is, you know, the educational content does well, but it's the boogeyman and the browser stories that do the best.
Right. So based on all this instantaneous market data that you've collected, I want to spin this question a little bit.
Sure.
I'm kind of optimistic about the progress that we've made in software security since I started working on it in about 97. And so I'm wondering if, from your broad perspective on the entire industry, whether you're also optimistic about that, you know, software security as a subfield, but also what the data have to say about it.
Yes. The first part of your question, absolutely. I think in my discussions with you and other folks in the field, the software security problem seems like it's getting the most attention of just about anything right now.
Really? So I sort of think that too, but I'm completely biased by standing right in the middle of it.
Right, yeah. You're right in the middle of the storm, so it seems like, you know, it's raining everywhere. But I think the Microsoft folks have done a really good job, you know, getting their house in order. And they've sort of gone, in the last couple of years, gone out and preached that gospel to other places as well, their mm-hmm. customers and their partners.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, companies like yours and others are doing the same thing. And it is getting a lot of attention. It's getting attention in the government, especially in the defense side of things. And I think that's all to the good. It's certainly going to be a long process because these projects take a long time, and it takes a long time to get these developers retrained or to get a new sort of crop of young developers who have this ingrained in them from the start.
Right.
Working on projects. But yeah, I'm certainly optimistic about the way things are moving right now.
Well, that's good. I'm kind of surprised to hear that, actually. So one of the things I just recently did was gathered up all the numbers I could find from 2007. And the revenue numbers for people in the field, either selling tools or selling services or selling pizza boxes to bolt onto your pile,
right. Yeah.
Are growing. So the field is about maybe, you know, 375 to 425 million, software security, that is.
Wow.
If you don't count application firewalls. And that's a good sizable field.
It certainly is, yeah.
I think that there is some room for optimism. We have a long, long way to go, though. I think that what we've done is just barely get over the early adopter curve, and we're getting into the middle market now.
Yeah, I mean, how many of the people that you talk to on a regular, you know, for the first time when you say software security, they don't really understand what you're talking about?
Not very many anymore. I mean, in 99, it used to be 100%.
Yeah.
Like, even my mom looked at me like I was crazy.
Sure.
And then now people just get a really worried look on their face. Like, oh, yeah, I should be doing that. What is it I should be doing again?
Right.
You know, we've talked about the retirement worry analogy.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like that. So another question, just to change the channel a bit. So some aspects of computer security are inherently rife with politics, like electronic voting or trusted computing,
right,
or wiretapping internet signals. So does the tech press cover these things? And, you know, is that an important part of what you do?
In very limited areas of the tech press. I wrote a number of stories about those kinds of things when I was at eWeek. I've done a few since I got to TechTarget, but not as many as I'd like. That kind of stuff is fascinating to me, maybe just because I grew up outside of D.C. and, you know, it was the political thing was always right there. But I always enjoyed covering that aspect of it, and I think there's definitely a valuable, there's some value that the tech press can add there, because there's a lot of ways that technology intersects with politics these days, and it's really not getting a ton of coverage.
No, and there's sort of two major problems. You know, one is that the politicians who are setting policy and making laws don't necessarily understand the technology.
Exactly.
And two is the people that are building the technology often don't think of the ramifications of what it is that they're building.
That's right, and they don't talk to each other. And, you know, I've sat in on God knows how many congressional subcommittee hearings where, you know, you have these experts up there testifying about some, you know, security issue, and the committee members are asking these questions that are the most basic and completely, you know, inane questions that really have no bearing on what the experts are there to testify about.
Right.
And
they're just saying stuff.
Right. They're saying things to be on TV. I know it's frustrating for the people who are actually testifying, and it's got to be frustrating for the rest of the industry as well to not be that well understood.
Well, I think we're quickly moving past the series of tubes generation.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
Especially with the latest developments in Alaska.
Right.
So, more personal question. When you're running with your Nike Plus, that iPod doohickey,
yeah,
strapped to your body, do you ever worry about the risk of being tracked by some sort of clever attacker? Like, have you read Yoshi Kono's work about that?
I have, and I think it's great. I haven't thought much about the risk of that, only because I figure I don't run fast enough to get away from anybody who really wants to find me anyway. So if they wanted to find me, they could kind of just chase me down the street. But
there are probably better people to blackmail out there too.
That's right. Yeah, there's richer, faster runners than me that would be better off. But when I first started running, I was completely sort of out of the technological loop, and I just went out and ran and didn't want any of that. You know, I didn't want even a stopwatch to know how fast or slow I was running. But mm-hmm. Since then, it's definitely, I've gotten that. I've got the GPS watch, you know, I've got all of that kind of stuff. I track myself to death, so it's, and I think it does take some of the joy out of it at some level, though, you know.
It'll turn into a job. You'll have to go back to something else.
Right, exactly. Yeah, just sit on the couch and eat Doritos.
Right. So speaking of jobs, which job is more fun, being a fry cook at Hardee's or being a PR guy?
Wow. I would have to say being a fry cook at Hardee's.
You know. I don't know, man. I really thought about that question long and hard and wondered what you were going to answer.
You've been in fast food restaurants, I'm sure.
Not in the back.
No, but you can imagine what it's like, and you can also, you've seen the backside of PR as well.
Oh, man, that strikes me somehow as worse.
Yes, that's right. So you know how that sausage is made. And, you know, at Hardee's, at the time that I was working there, there was nothing good happening, and it lasted, I think, about 6 weeks. And, you know, it was... I think it lasted just enough time for my dad to say, all right, you know, you've proved that you can stick it out.
You don't have to do that anymore.
Right, a really crummy job, so go find something else.
My crummy job was bagging groceries.
Yeah, that's bad too, but it's not, you know,
It isn't stinky, but boy, right, does it hurt your back after 10 hours in a row.
Yeah, there's that. But, you know, there's not the ever-present danger of, like, sticking your hand into a vat of, you know, boiling lard or, you know, having some guy reach across the counter and wring your neck. But, you know, that was I'd have to go with Hardee's being a better job. All things considered, they lasted about the same amount of time, I'll say that.
Well, thanks much. This has been really fun.
I've had a great time. Thanks a lot, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The September-October 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine is a special issue dedicated to virtualization, co-edited by Sean Smith and Sam King. Silver Bullet's co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.